on this episode of Skeptico.
So when you get someone who is, say, well-intentioned, who is writing for the New York Times or whatever, their whole education and background and indoctrination and study is rely upon what is published in these peer-reviewed accepted medical journals as fact. And therefore, yes, if you looked at all of these studies, you would say vaccines are safe and effective. So what's the problem? But you would have to go one level deeper, which these people are not willing to do, in order to discover that what they are relying on and calling science is actually fraud. They don't know that. They don't want to know that. They don't, in some cases, even know that this level of fraud exists. They're incurious people. They don't have that kind of independent curiosity that leads them to go where they will on their own.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we're going to talk to investigative journalist John Rappaport. And this is a show that I've been wanting to bring to you for a while. This topic of who we can trust and why we can trust them and how we investigate and get to the bedrock of truth has been something that pops up over and over again on this show. And this particular topic with regards to medicine and health and vaccines and science really has been on my mind and has been percolating for a while. And it really came home to me the other day when I was driving back from the movies with my wife. And in our family, my wife is kind of the medical expert, if you will. She has a PhD in psychology, and she used to do medical rounds in a hospital. And I can't even stand to drive by a hospital, so that kind of makes her the medical expert in our family. And for whatever reason, the movie had kind of provoked Joni, and she was getting pretty worked up about the instances of polio that have popped up in other parts of the world. And in the media, they immediately draw a connection to people's lack in confidence of vaccines or worry about vaccines and that this is a really horrible, dangerous thing. And look at all these kids who are now getting polio again. But what I immediately said to Joni was, I said, well, what about this guy from the CDC, this whistleblower, this William Thompson, who spent years hiding the fact that the measles vaccine really does dramatically increase the chance that your child will develop autism? And then she paused and she looked at me with this strange look like, what on earth are you talking about? And the reason she did is because she's smart and she's well-informed and she listens to Today's Show and she reads articles on medicine and she blogs for Psychology Today. She would know if this kind of monumental science fraud had been disclosed by an insider, a whistleblower, someone who was involved in the study. Surely she'd know, because this would be front page news week after week after week. Anyone who's interested in medicine would know about this.
Oh my God, I cannot believe we did what we did. But we did. It's all there. It's all there.
This is a real story of a real fraud.
It's the lowest point in my career that I went along with that paper.
Deliberate, high-level deception of the American people with disastrous consequences for its children's health.
Now, the voices you hear there are, number one, Dr. William Thompson, longtime researcher of vaccines for the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who is the unfortunate pawn in this game, who was a hardworking doctor in the UK who was trying to help patients, mothers who were coming to him, telling him that their kids had developed autism and that they had a strong suspicion that the autism was related to the vaccine that they had received. Now, that full video, including the heartfelt confession that Dr. Thompson eventually felt after years and years of holding this secret in, he felt like he had to tell Dr. Wakefield that he was partially responsible for this career-crushing lie that was perpetrated by him and others at the CDC. So that video will be linked in this show. But just as important, or maybe more importantly than the data related to vaccines and autism, is how this story is not reported and the questions that that raises about science reporting in general. So in my interview with John Rappaport today, we're going to talk about Dr. William Thompson, the whistleblower from the CDC, and what's really going on with vaccines. But we're also going to talk about the larger issue of science reporting, of investigative journalism, and why it's not about the data, it's about everything else. So it was great having John on the show. I really enjoyed talking to him, and I hope to talk to him again. He's got some interesting views on consciousness, but I felt like we really need to handle that in a separate interview, so hopefully we'll get to that at some point in the future. I hope you enjoy my conversation with John Rappaport. Today we welcome Pulitzer Prize-nominated investigative journalist John Rappaport to Skeptico. In addition to being a highly regarded and prolific journalist and blogger, John is author of three really fantastic collections on his various investigations. You're going to want to check those out. I'm going to have links to all those in the show notes. And he's also quite an accomplished painter and a poet, a true Renaissance man in our presence today. John, thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Good to be here, Alex. Thank you.
So I've been playing around with a little bit of a different format on this show, and you are kind of one of the guinea pigs. So it might appear as we're talking here that we're kind of jumping around on some different stuff, maybe even repeating some stuff. I want to cover a lot of ground and leave myself room to figure out kind of how to publish this stuff. I'm trying to not only publish these podcasts, but do more and more blogging and getting information out there because, hey, man, it's just so hard to reach people nowadays. It's wonderful that people have so many sources of information. I can only imagine what it seems like to you, given the length of time you've been at this kind of investigative journalism. In ways, it has to seem kind of like a glory days in terms of this information is out there in greater mass than we probably ever could have imagined a while ago, huh?
Yes, no question about that. And also, equally important, the ease of publishing of my work. Because, of course, when I was working as a reporter before the internet took hold, because I started working as a reporter in 1982, you know, you had to go through editors and pitch stories and wait for a green light to go ahead. And there would be as much as a month or two before a piece was actually published. So the whole game has changed completely. And it's quite fantastic. I mean, there's never been anything like it for a writer.
Yeah, no, or for a consumer, or for a truth seeker, if you want to use that word. Anyone who's interested in something beyond the mainstream status quo view, I mean, it really is just a tremendously open opportunity to get a whole variety of different opinions, even on the alternative views, which I think is extremely helpful.
Sure, no question about it. Because you can go deeper and then even deeper on certain issues and events, approach it from many different angles, which I do, and cover a variety of subjects, which I do. So there's no limit for anyone who wants to take up the sword, so to speak.
Right. So I'll tell you what I'd like to do to start this. And I've been thinking about this for a little while, and I really love your reporting on the vaccine controversy. I've referenced it in several shows and link it up to people whenever I can. And I kind of thought that maybe we could try and quickly go through that from beginning to end. It's a huge topic, and you've written many, many posts on it. Folks, when I say posts, this is a true investigative journalist who's using his well-honed skills of interviewing, investigating, document searching. So these are true investigative posts that John has done in connection with the vaccine controversy. But when I step back, I say, gee, what would have penetrated for me, for Alex Sequeira, 7 or 8 years ago before I started Skeptico and before I I guess, was kind of awake to maybe some of the different realities that are out there that I'm living in. And I think if someone approached me with surveillance state, constructed reality, or any of that stuff, it just wouldn't have gotten through. And the reason is because I considered myself an intelligent guy, a smart guy, a successful guy, somebody who knew how to kind of navigate the world and that, you know, I need to be skeptical of things, but I never would have been prepared for this level of managed information that is so completely contrary to the mainstream narrative that we get. So I'd like to, if I can, try and take you back to when this issue of vaccines first popped up on your radar. What was the, do you remember what the first piece of information that kind of brought it to your attention? And then if you can kind of take us back and take us through how you began to investigate it.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to say 1987. I was writing my first book called AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century. And I had already worked as a reporter for about 5 years. And so I was investigating sources of immune suppression around the planet that had nothing to do with the HIV virus. I was looking for them because I had seen already that the proof that HIV caused AIDS was completely inadequate. And I knew what the so-called high-risk groups were for what was being called AIDS.
And just to kind of interject, because we just did a show on this, and just to fill people in, if that throws them for a loop and they thought they already knew that, of course, HIV causes AIDS and all the rest of this. We just did a show on this and people can reference it. But what you bump into is the headline of our show was, you know, UN says African-American women 20 times more likely to contract HIV AIDS. These are the kind of demographic information, scientific demographic information that you quickly run into that just completely doesn't fit the existing narrative. So if people are thrown off by that, go listen to that other show or just read John's book or excellent writing on that, and you'll see that there's anyone who looks into it very, very far immediately comes face to face with some pretty unresolvable evidence, right? That at a very high level just makes you suspicious of the AIDS, HIV existing narrative.
Yeah, sure. That's correct. That's what you would find if you scratch below the surface. But one of the things that is the common denominator among all these so-called high-risk groups is the concept of immune system suppression, destruction of the immune system. And so I began looking for other sources in these various groups that would explain the immune suppression that existed, for example, in gay men in San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles, Africans, Haitians, IV drug users, hemophiliacs, etc. And I found different causes. And so I began to, that had nothing to do with HIV. So I began to broaden my investigation. And eventually I came to vaccines. So what about vaccines as a source of immune system suppression? And I researched fairly deeply on this, and I found a great deal of information from the writings and the research of a number of authors, including, for example, a book that was written in 1898 in England that showed, contrary to the popular narrative, the original smallpox vaccine was complicit in causing epidemics of smallpox in certain English cities, whereas in cities where there was almost no vaccination or very little, the rates of smallpox were much, much, much lower. So that's just for starters. And then I found a number of studies and reports that showed the destructive effects of vaccines, all kinds of different vaccines. And this, of course, would impact the immune system. severely impact the immune system. And then I skipped from there to a very large experimental study that was done on gay men in New York with a new vaccine at the time called the hepatitis V vaccine. And they were looking for healthy gay men to try this vaccine out on. And from everything that I could see, the effects were extremely destructive. Very easy to call this eventually AIDS. And also, there's an additional factor there, which is that the HIV blood test later developed would register positive for HIV in many cases where what it was really registering on was the fact that a person had gotten the hepatitis B vaccine. So now you have a closed circle. You have an individual who is adversely affected, destructively affected by the hepatitis B vaccine, a gay man in New York, say. His immune system is severely compromised, which opens him up to multiple opportunistic infections that ordinarily his body would reject. In other words, he's showing the profile of so-called AIDS. And if he gets tested for HIV, the test looks positive because it is reacting not on the presence of HIV, but on the fact that he had received the hepatitis B vaccine. So now he's diagnosed as having AIDS. But the original effect was produced by a vaccine. So these were some of the things that I was discovering back in 1987 that led me to eventually a much wider investigation and thought process about the destructive effects of vaccine.
You know, we should add to the mix here. And again, that's going to throw people for a huge loop there. The idea that AIDS in the initial infection is somehow connected to a vaccine that was administered as part of a scientific experiment is going to be a moonshot for people. They're not going to be able to go there. But even if we kept it on a very simple, basic, common narrative level, I think one of the things that people don't understand, and I certainly didn't understand until I investigated it, is that vaccines have always been a crapshoot. I mean, everyone from the beginning in medicine understands the risks associated with vaccines, and it's always been a balancing act of weighing the potential benefits, however you measure those to be, versus the risks. And moreover, like when it comes to the polio vaccine, which is now kind of hot news again, the way they, at least back then, and still in a lot of cases do, manufacture the vaccine is they culture it in, the original polio vaccine was cultured in monkey livers. So they'd take the liver and they'd chop it up and they'd culture the vaccine in that mix of body parts there, of monkey body parts. And in the process of doing that, they knew they were introducing other viruses. You can't help but do it. You can't isolate out, at that detailed microscopic biological level, all the different viruses in that body. So they know that some are coming along for the ride. They just hope some of them, they just hope those aren't destructive. And, you know, for anyone who's interested in investigating that, I'd encourage them to do it because there's a whole bunch of potential controversies associated with what might have come from that initial 250 million or whatever it was batch of polio vaccines back in the 50s and what detrimental health effects that might have introduced into the population. But my real point is just that I wanted to get out there that, you know, vaccines have never been a magic bullet, and even the best of mainstream status quo medicine doesn't even suggest that it is. So
I would disagree with you completely. The entire propaganda machine of the medical complex is devoted to claiming that vaccines are extraordinarily safe and extraordinarily effective. And anyone who questions that is a conspiracy theorist and a dangerous person. That is the current position of the Centers for Disease Control and the American Medical Association and the National Institutes of Health and university professors who claim to know everything about vaccines, and the U.S. government as a general policy of the government.
You're right, John. What I'm just saying is, it like before, if you scratch below the surface even a little bit, you can get folks to admit that, you know, in the manufacturing process of vaccines, just in our history, you know, the polio vaccine, the initial polio vaccine that Salk, you know, whatever, developed, I mean, it killed a bunch of people. So they had to pull it back and then re-engineer it and do all this. So I'm just saying, I agree with you. You know, there's the official narrative in this, but if you scratch below the surface and you think you're a smart guy, you get to the point of saying, okay, there is some risk there, but the risk is balanced with the reward. And I know you're going two steps further than that, which I hear you on as well.
Okay. Also, I want to point out something. Judging what people can accept, what they will be willing to research on their own or investigate and so on and so forth, that's always a crapshoot to me.
Yes.
So therefore, to characterize some of the things that I say as moonshots for most people, what I've discovered over the last 14 years that I've been publishing on the internet is that I take my findings and I present them, period. I don't try to water them down or make them more generalized or cater to people who would not, quote, be able to accept what I'm saying. And what I've discovered is, if I go with what I have found out in an uncompromising way, the audience is there and it builds and it expands. And I consider that a very important clue for people who are, for example, considering becoming investigators or researchers on their own. What do you do when you find out something that is so profoundly at odds with the consensus? What do you do? Do you shape it? Do you sculpt it in a way that will be more acceptable to a larger number of people from your point of view, in your estimation, or do you just shoot the moon and give it out? Here it is. This is it. And my feeling and conclusion based on my experience is you do the latter. If you always do the latter, in other words, present exactly what it is that you found and explain it and give evidence for it and so forth, then you win. If you don't, then you end up in a kind of gray twilight zone where you accomplish far less in the long run.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just couldn't agree with you more. And I've just learned that. I think I had somewhat of an instinct for that anyway, but it's kind of the tagline of the Skeptico show. Follow the data wherever it leads. So you just keep following the data, and report on it. And just as an aside, I've seen the effects of trying to play that middle ground. Like I said, it's the middle ground that doesn't hold, you know. I've seen it in parapsychology, where parapsychology tried to accommodate science, if you will, you know, mainstream science, and they wound up just compromising themselves out of existence, you know, like they were trying to position their work as being, oh no, this fits into science. And in a way, it undermined the credibility they were seeking. And I see the same thing happening to a certain extent in near-death experience science, because there's a lot of people in near-death experience research that are connected with the medical community and for understandable reasons want to hold on to their job, their livelihood, but also just the prestige that goes with that. So they're trying to accommodate their findings and fit it back into this neurological, nonsensical, materialistic model of consciousness.
I'll give you another example of that. What's happened to the practice of chiropractic over the last maybe 30 or 40 years? You've now got a profession that is tilting more and more and more toward a medical model, right, which had nothing to do with original chiropractic or the idea of adjustments and subluxation and so forth. And so you've got scores and scores and scores of people who now graduate from chiropractic colleges who apparently know really very little, if anything, about the original concept of how you adjust people, because they've been taught in a way that skews their whole education toward appeasing the medical model of existence and of treatment and so forth. And so you've got people, you know, in a profession who are hoping that they can be considered on a level with medical doctors. Well, that is like shooting yourself in the head. That's professional suicide.
Yeah. No, I hear you. But I want to return to this other point, too, and explore that a little further, because, you know, you've been at this longer and your eyes have been forced open a lot longer than mine have. I mean, really, 8 years ago, like I said before, it just wouldn't have penetrated. And I return to that, I think, at least in my mind, I return to that on this show and I go, wow, if I was talking to myself back then, without sugarcoating it, without dumbing it down, how might it have been a way to unlock some of the blocks that I had, a way to open me up? Because that is, at the end of the day, the process that we're all going through. We're all going through this learning process, this growing process. What I set out to do on this show was to answer these big picture questions. Who am I? Why am I here? How can I make better decisions about my life? And I felt like science and consciousness were somehow tied up in that answer. I wish I could have gotten to the point where I'm at sooner. And so one of my goals is to try and help other people follow that same path, but maybe not have to take as much time. Now, I hear what you're saying, which is, you know, you just have to deliver the news and let people do with it what they may. But I think there is an element of evolution to this, and we can all kind of turn back the clock and go, okay, for people who are probably starting in this area, what is some of the information that would start that process? So without dumbing it down, I'd return us to the vaccine thing. And maybe we want to jump ahead in the story to when the Dr. Andrew Wakefield story breaks, because I think that's a point at which this thing rose up to an attention level and got this massive play among the media. It became very divisive, but I think it also opened people up to saying, hey, is there something there I need to look into? Should I be concerned about the safety of my kids vis-a-vis autism? It became an issue. So maybe if you can, take us back to what you remember about that period and what your thought process was as you saw this unbelievable attack on Dr. Andrew Wakefield. But you have to start with, you know, what's going on at that period? What's going on in your mind? And who is this guy, Andrew Wakefield?
Okay, so we would go back about 20 years now. By this point, it was clear to me there was no problem in realizing that vaccines were neither safe nor effective for many reasons, which, you know, I could take the next 3 hours to explain. So when Wakefield's story broke, I looked at it. It seemed fairly mild. In other words, his research findings, which were published in England, seemed fairly mild because he was just doing a case study report on a handful of children who were patients.
And quickly summarize what his finding was, because he was a gastro and...
Yeah. So what he found basically was, in autistic children, there were gastrointestinal problems. And maybe these problems were associated with a measles virus. And maybe that virus had come through the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, which is a very popular vaccine mandated all over the world.
And let me just interject really quickly, because, and everybody knows this, but I'll add it to the story, or maybe not everybody knows this, but I'll add it to the story. He had patients who had come to him, mothers, who had said, look, I know it was related to the vaccine. I know it's related to the shot. My kid was perfectly normal. He had a shot. He got sick. He never really recovered from it. And the next thing you know, these symptoms are showing up. So he has all these patients who are quite convinced, as mothers know their kids like no one else, they were assured that that was true. And he had a unique insight into it because of his background in these gastrointestinal disorders, which seemed to him to be coexisting with the autism, right? So go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, that's what Wakefield was making out of it 20 years ago. He wasn't saying that he had come to the unshakable conclusion that it was the vaccine. He hadn't done a broad study. He never intended to. He was reporting on cases. And then a journalist or two in England got a hold of this and decided to try to make a gigantic story out of it and accuse Wakefield of fraud, scientific fraud, and going too far. And that story convinced many parents in England to become alarmed about the vaccine. And then that became the story, because the medical establishment in England came down very hard on this and said, well, if parents are now saying that they don't want to have their children injected with this vaccine, now we're going to have tremendous problems and disease is going to spread rampant all over the place. And then the story became, and we can blame it all on Wakefield. And so they eventually stripped his license to practice medicine, destroyed his career, and he left England and settled in the United States.
And what time period is this?
Well, this would be around the year 2000, coming forward a few years maybe from there, but, you know, early part of the 20th century. And so I can cap this off by flash forwarding to the summer of 2014, last summer, about a year ago, when all of a sudden a CDC, Centers for Disease Control, long-term researcher, very respected, published lots of vaccine studies, his name is William Thompson, confesses publicly in writing on the website of his attorney, Rick Morgan, Cincinnati, that he and his colleagues in 2004 cooked the data on a study of this MMR vaccine and thereby excluded the possibility that the vaccine had any connection to autism, when in fact the data they excluded showed that there was a connection to autism. He does this in writing, William Thompson of the CDC.
He does it in writing, and people can also go on YouTube and listen to
him talking.
Yes, tell us about
that.
He's
talking to Andrew Wakefield. He's talking to a PhD named Brian Hooker. He's talking in a tone of voice that is shot through with guilt and remorse and stricken conscience. And he is also saying things like, for any of the vaccines that still contain mercury, you would have to be crazy, you know, to give these vaccines to anybody, much less a child. There are many other parts to this story, which would take us, you know, well beyond this hour. But then the media, major media, blacks out this story, which is a gigantic story. It's a story of fraud, scientific fraud, having to do with vaccines and their harmful causation of autism. And only certain websites are carrying this story, one of which is mine, No More Fake News. And I'm writing about this every day, and I'm getting more information about this. Thompson is refusing to talk to reporters. He's in a very bad place because he's still working at the CDC. He's obviously had conversations with his bosses there. And I'll give you one more tidbit. The study that we're talking about in question, the 2004 study on the MMR vaccine, was co-authored by Thompson. But two of his other authors on the study, Frank DiStefano and Colleen Boyle, who work at the CDC, are not only researchers and authors, they also happen to be high-ranking executives at the CDC in the area of vaccine safety. So this now, I mean, is the kind of story that not only should boil over on page one of every major media outlet in the world, but it should prompt further investigation to see what else comes out of the closet. But it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. And then if we flash forward another year to the end of July 2015, Congressman William Posey of Florida, who's been in contact with the whistleblower, William Thompson, stands up on the floor of the House of Representatives and says, I am now going to read a statement from William Thompson. And in this statement, which is a quote, Thompson is saying, he and his co-authors on this study are sitting in an office at the CDC and bring in a large garbage can and proceed to throw out pages of documents that implicate the MMR vaccine and its connection to autism. I mean, from a reporter's point of view, can you ask for a bigger story than that?
No.
And we're now talking about the implication not only of the vaccine in autism, but also the enormous corruption present at the CDC. Only the tip of an iceberg for an investigative reporter if he could get in the door, because there are undoubtedly many other stories there lurking in the shadows at the CDC ready to come out when pressure is applied. The kind of pressure, for example, that was applied during the Watergate investigation of the early 1970s.
Right. But as you're pointing out, I mean, to a certain extent, we don't even need any pressure. I mean, the evidence is right here in front of us, and yet it's, I love the term you used, blackout.
Yeah.
There's a complete blackout. What stuns me is when I bring this topic up to people, they are completely ignorant of it, completely dumbfounded, like, what are you talking about? How could that be? I haven't heard of it. And this is a story that if we go back 10 years, like you're talking about, this was constant news. You know, the Jenny McCarthy and the controversy and these crazy vaccine nuts. And, you know, what are the schools going to do? Because all these crazy homeschoolers don't want to vaccinate their kids. And we have to protect the herd. And if everyone doesn't get their vaccine, then we're all at risk. This was drilled into us over and over and over. And when we juxtapose this with the complete silence from, as you say, I mean, imagine these high-ranking scientists at the Center for Disease Control sitting around in a meeting room with a garbage can, sorting through the documents and saying, what do we have to get rid of so that we don't get implicated in this major cover-up? I mean,
let me give you another piece, quick. Back in 2004, when Thompson, the whistleblower, originally discovers, you know, that in their research, they're uncovering a connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. He writes a letter to Julie Gerberding, who is the head of the CDC, And he says, look, I'm about to present data on this at a major vaccine conference, CDC conference, coming right up here. And I'm in a difficult spot because I have very sensitive and troubling information about the vaccine. What am I going to do? He's between a rock and a hard place. And so from all that I've been able to gather, and I looked into this as far as I could possibly look into it, Julie Gerberding never replies to him. His presentation at that conference, which would have included reporters and parents and scientists and all kinds of people, that presentation was canceled, never happened. Okay. This is all 2004 now. Fast forward 5 years to 2009, Julie Gerberding, the head of the CDC, leaves the CDC and eventually takes up a position with Merck Pharmaceuticals as the CEO or the president of their vaccine division. And Merck manufactures the MMR vaccine. So, again, from a reporter's point of view, big story. Are you kidding? If a big-time media outlet, let's just say the New York Times or the Washington Post, let their hounds loose on this story and said, okay, boys, to the reporters, look, we got a major story here. This is incredible. You know, let's say this is 2014 and Thompson has blown the whistle. We're going to look into every nook and cranny. And the reason you came in to be a journalist is finally going to be realized now, right? After all these years of writing, you know, pap and nonsense and slanted, information, you're finally going to get a chance. and we're going to press on this for the next year. And people are going to come out of the closet, professionals, scientists, doctors, and they're going to start blowing the whistle on themselves and everybody else, because you're going to apply enough pressure, which is what gets this to happen. And we're going to blow this up to the sky with relentless reporting. If they did that, I can guarantee you, and we're talking about newspapers now that are drowning in red ink and right. bankruptcy. The New York Times is refinancing the refinancing of the refinancing right. of their debt in order to stay in business, right? If the newspapers dared to do this, the big ones, they could print two print editions a day on the newsstands, and they would sell out like hotcakes, because the public would just eat this up by the truckload. Because one thing I've learned about the American public, and in fact the public all over the world, is that when you tell them what's actually going on in uncompromising terms, their IQ suddenly and magically and mysteriously leaps up, and they come awake and they say, my God, you know. And if major media are doing this, you see, so that the kind of person that you talk to who said, how could this be? I've never heard about it, and so on. If that objection is now cast aside because they are hearing about it every day in a new story, Professor so-and-so at Harvard admits that, yes, there have been problems with this vaccine all along, and he was in the lead to try to get it taken off the list of the CDC-mandated vaccines, but he was stopped by somebody from Merck, or this, you know, this thing explodes. These newspapers would be back in clover again. And even though they would lose pharmaceutical vaccine money or advertising money, so what? They would have new advertisers coming on board like crazy, because when you sell millions of newspapers all of a sudden in print, advertisers will just line up to take out ads. But you see, and I speak now from 30 years of experience as an investigative reporter, this will never happen, because these press outlets are part and parcel of the same establishment that is covering up the truth about vaccines. It's not, forget about objective or dispassionate reporting. This is the club we're talking about. The club includes these media outlets, and includes the CDC, and includes the CIA, and includes the American Medical Association, and includes the pharmaceutical companies. They're all in this together. So this will never happen. These media outlets would go bankrupt gladly first, than to violate their sacred oath to be part of the club, which therefore leaves the story to us.
Enter the Matrix.
Yes.
So we leap from the fact-based, follow the data, undeniable. Again, folks, if you are new to this story, the thing that I think, and John, you touched on it, is the emotional-laden, cathartic confession of Thompson on these video calls, which are, on these telephone calls, which are available on YouTube. Say it all. Because there was some backpedaling, right, by the CDC. They tried to manage control and issue. Let's cover that just a little bit.
Sure.
How did they try and spin out of this and soften the blow? Because I thought that's very, it shows a real subtlety and a real nuanced kind of approach that I think is very instructive as well, right?
Yeah. Well, since I've been at this for 30 years, it came as no surprise to me that, A, the CDC would do a little bit of damage control, nor did it surprise me how they did it. It's very simple. The co-authors of the study come forward and they say, well, look, this is a matter of professional dialogue. There is always going to be a certain degree of disagreement as to which data have more substance and importance than these other data over here. And yes, there was discussion about this, and at professionals do, as they do, there was some disagreement. But on the whole, we determined for various reasons that the data that we omitted was not really good data, and that if we included it in the study, then it would give a skewed picture of the true results of our research and investigation, blah, 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 blah. In other words, a kind of very, very casual, matter-of-fact tone. We're not bothered. We're not disturbed. This is not a scandal. Farthest thing from it. It's just business as usual. This does happen. And Dr. Thompson is, he can have his own view on what happened here. Right. But the consensus is really that this was not a problem. And everybody goes away. See, because major media don't care, because they never intended to study to cover this in the first place. So they issue a little article, CDC explains problem with study, blah, blah, and nobody cares. And then we just move on. That's how they do it. That's how they always do it. But you see, if these media outlets really were dedicated to investigative journalism, this kind of denial by the CDC would just be water off their backs. They would say, yeah, well, what do you expect them to say? You know, this is not going to stop us. We're going to keep pressing on, and we're going to be relentless, and we're going to throw the truth in their faces at every chance we get. And eventually, we're going to force people to admit what really happened. And once we do that, and we print that and publish that, then we are putting pressure on yet other people who are concealing the truth, and they are going to get scared, and eventually they will come out of the closet. That's how it all works. That's how it always works when you investigate enough, when you have a team, when you have money behind you, when you have prestige and reputation behind you, so that people in Washington and Congress, the White House, government agencies care about what stories are on page one of the New York Times or the Washington Post. Now you've got leverage. Now you can force the truth out into the open. That's the ideal. That's what should happen. But of course, it doesn't.
And if we can get a little bit conspiratorial for a minute, and you've seen this play out so many times that you can speak to it much better than I can, but the part of the game plan here in terms of the soft denial isn't to reject the counter opinion. It's just to cast doubt on the whole situation, to turn it into yet another fist fight in the street that we look at for a minute and then turn our head away from. Only this is a very professional one, right? So it's done in a way to that is a familiar pattern, but it's not an outright denial. It's just to throw sand into the person's face and just kind of confuse everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, I would liken it to a lawyer who's standing in front of a very friendly judge. What does that lawyer have to do or say that's going to get the friendly judge to agree with him? Well, very little. Mm. You know, he's just going to have to say, well, Your Honor, in this case, yakety yakety yak, and the judge is going to nod and say, yes, I've considered this and I agree. And so the objection is overruled and we're going to move on. You know, that's all it takes, because you don't have major media who are really looking over the shoulder and determined to find out the truth. So you need, with this soft denial, to do very little for everybody to move on and ignore what's really happening.
You know, the other aspect of this that I think is revealing, maybe you can touch on, what I've noticed is a new narrative that's also emerged recently, and that's the pumping up of the polio on the rise. Here's another infectious disease that's coming back. And it's not even so veiled, but it's a slightly veiled connection between we really do need these vaccines without ever directly addressing the issue at hand with the CDC and all the rest of it. It's just kind of indirectly, remember, vaccines are your friends. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've been covering phony epidemics for the last, 25, 30. And each one of these, West Nile, SARS, swine flu, bird flu, et cetera, They are all promoted to the hilt by World Health Organization, the CDC, and so forth, in part to keep the vaccine issue in front of the public and to scare them and to say, look, all of these diseases are emerging. They're coming back. Some of them are new. We've never seen them before. They're all caused by germs, by viruses, and our only real protection against this is vaccines. So one after another, you have the ideal promotional PR propaganda efforts to convince the public that vaccines are not only important, but without them, we would all perish. That's really now starting to dig into matrix land. The reason for these duds of epidemics is to keep that going, just as you described, and to make sure that everybody is in a state of anxiety so that vaccines become the most important things to protect families and so on and so forth. And I could give you chapter and verse on each one of these vaccine epidemics that I call duds to show to you that it was always clear that nothing was going to come of any of these, quote, horror stories, that it was always a very small number of people who maybe we're not even sure that that small number of people actually were suffering from whatever the current epidemic was being called. It was all a ruse. It was all based on false science. I could give you chapter and verse on it, and it would be utterly shocking to most people. So yes, that's the game plan. That's the way it's done. That's how it works. The CDC, I'm going to say maybe 10 years ago, held a conference about which you can read, in which the theme, I think the man's name was Glenn Nowak, he was a PR guy at the CDC, you know, presented in charts. You know, this is the strategy for getting people to vaccinate. We have to overemphasize the problem. We have to scare people. We have to do this. We have to do that. Here's the agenda. This is what we do. This is all orchestrated.
So let's jump over to the other side. Is I don't want to directly address the matrix because, as we were talking about before, I think it gets too hard for people to really pull it in a way that it kind of makes sense. Now, taking into account what you said before is you just have to lay bare the truth and let it happen. But we'll leave that. You can go check out John's excellent books, three of them, that directly address the extent, the beginnings, the purpose, goals of the matrix. So that's all there. One of the points that I think is another point of confusion for a lot of people is that there's a lot of good people who aren't quote-unquote in the matrix, if you will, but nonetheless wind up parroting the same party line in a way that they're not even aware of. And I just think it might be interesting to get your take on how that works. And I'll give you two examples. I wrote a little blog post that I sent you recently in response to George Johnson, who's a well-respected science writer, New York Times guy. And there he is, you know, bemoaning the loss of credibility of science and how science doesn't carry the same weight with people, how people are questioning science. And one of his lead issues are vaccines. He's like, wow, how are we losing the hard-won consensus on vaccines? And I guess my point is, and I don't know George Johnson. I know a friend of his, John Horgan, who I interviewed on this show, nice guy. But I don't suspect that he's getting money on the side from the CDC or from the Matrix or the CIA or anything. I get the sense that he's just someone who's learned in a way that he doesn't even completely understand a set of beliefs that cause him to write these stories in a way. And then if the Matrix has anything to do with it, they just see, oh, here's someone who seems to be vibrating at our same frequency. Let's make sure that his information rises to the top. And, oh, here's a dissenter and his information, his tuning fork isn't quite vibrating the way we want. So let's just make sure his job opportunities and his promotion doesn't go the same way. Now, I'm just totally speculating on that. I think you have a much better perspective on it. How does it happen that good, otherwise well-educated, well-intentioned people wind up parroting this really destructive crap that if they would investigate a little bit, would see is completely untrue?
Well, we only have a few minutes, so I'll have to boil it down. But I'll mention that, and I've published these statements many times as quotes, Marcia Angel was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years. Recently, we had a similar statement from the editor of The Lancet, who that's one of the other most prestigious medical journals in the world. And basically what Angel said was, in writing in 2009 in the New York Review of Books, reluctantly over the course of 20 years, I have come to the conclusion that I can no longer trust published medical studies or clinical reports from doctors. Right. Now, she has looked up close and personal and poured through more medical studies and clinical trial reports, et cetera, than anybody writing for the New York Times or any doctor practicing medicine in a hospital could even dream of doing. And she comes to that conclusion that the entire field is rife with fraud, rife with fraud. So when you get someone who is, say, well-intentioned, who is writing for the New York Times or whatever, their whole education and background and indoctrination and study is rely upon what is published in these peer-reviewed, accepted medical journals as fact. And therefore, yes, if you looked at all of these studies, you would say vaccines are safe and effective. So what's the problem? The people who say they aren't must be crazy. They're just unhinged. They're screaming in the night. They have no factual basis behind them. Therefore, this must signal some kind of decline of Western civilization and a loss of faith in science itself, which is what got us to this point in our civilization. That would be the obvious conclusion, you see. But you would have to go one level deeper, which these people are not willing to do, in order to discover that what they are relying on and calling science is actually fraud. They don't know that. They don't want to know that. They don't, in some cases, even know that this level of fraud exists. They're incurious people. They don't have that kind of independent curiosity that leads them to go where they will on their own. They attach themselves to what they consider to be the establishment, the best version of science, and they roll the dice on that for the rest of their lives. That's all they do. And that's why you see those articles there.
And there's also a certain part of human nature that wants us to go along, wants us to connect with other people in a way that doesn't create conflict at every turn. So for someone like that, for a science writer at the New York Times, you have you're getting it from a couple of different angles. One, you're getting it from science. And then two, you're getting it from your journalistic buddies too, who like to kind of fashion themselves as kind of mavericks and all the rest of this, but at the same time are very careful to not step too far outside of the lines and lose their job or lose their position in the paper where they're not getting front page, top of the fold kind of coverage, and they're back in section B, page 14 kind of thing. So there's a lot of...
Happens all the time. Happens all the time. It's now reached the point in major media where reporters instinctively know what they can do and what they can't do.
Right.
They don't need to be told. Only in the rare occasion does the word come down from the top. And reporters understand that they can lose their jobs, they can lose their careers. In other words, they will not only be demoted, they will be let go, and then they won't be able to find a job in the same level of media ever again. Blacklisted. This is what they're dealing with. This is the you got the carrot and the stick, and this is the stick. They know that. They understand it. Everybody knows the game.
Well, John, there's so many other subjects and topics that we could talk about, and I'd love to have you back on. We'll definitely have to do that. But to wrap up our discussion today, where I thought we might go with this is, I guess, the personal end game, if you will, because I know we both come to a very similar conclusion about personal empowerment, about the ability for us to use this information to affect change in our lives. This path, if you will, this truth-seeking path, this willingness to go against the grain, to fight the status quo, can be a very discouraging, and in a lot of ways, it can seem like a very lonely path. It can alienate you from friends, from family. I mean, my wife is awesome, and I love her, but I have to be very restrictive in how much of this I can really feed to her. She just isn't really open to hearing all this. She's a psychologist. She's trained with a PhD in a certain way of thinking, and it just doesn't penetrate in a lot of ways. And I think there's a lot of people out there that wind up in a similar situation. So with all that, what can someone do? What have you seen in terms of what kind of ways people can use this information to empower their lives, to change their lives, without falling into the despair of, oh my gosh, I'm in the matrix. There's nothing I can do.
Well, first, you have to know, based on your own investigation and research, what the truth is. And you have to be confident that you've discovered something that's true. So let's assume that that is possible for whoever we're talking about here. Once you have a grip on something that's true, that runs counter, seriously counter to the consensus reality, now you're in a new position. You have to recognize that. I'm not where I was before. Let's not be immature and childish about this. You know, our society is geared to childishness. Well, if you feel uncomfortable, there must be some way you can suddenly feel comfortable again. Because otherwise, why are we doing all this? Why do we have this country at all? You know, so people are very prone to thinking, well, gee, if I feel the slightest bit uncomfortable, then I don't want that, and therefore I'm just going to give up. Well, you have to get beyond that, because discovery of the truth is not childish. If you would be willing to admit it, it makes you feel more powerful. That's a good thing. You feel more alive. You feel more intelligent. You feel more on top of understanding what is actually going on in the world. It's a positive effect. The negative effect comes when you start to think about, what am I going to do now that I know these things? That takes intelligence as well. Are you going to spend your time like a child, arguing with people who have absolutely no interest in or chance of seeing what you're saying? Of course not. You're going to waste your energy on them. So what you need to do is find ways of expressing the truth, backing it up to the people who potentially can understand it. And you do this through speaking, you do this through writing, you do this through dialogue, you do this through finding people who are capable of opening their eyes. Is it the easiest thing in the world? Absolutely not. But if you keep your wits about you, it is very, very empowering, very, very positive. And as for the rest of the people who are not up to it, who can't accept it, you don't bother. Why bother? You're not trying to basically prove that they're wrong. I mean, that's not your sole mission in life. If it were, then you would be in a state of helpless anxiety all the time. You have higher purposes than that. Expression of what you discover is the second part of the equation. Communication of it, that's something you have to understand. That's a new thing as well. You know, it's like, okay, you go to some place where you had a map, and lo and behold, you discover an enormous treasure there. What are you going to do now? Are you going to suddenly pick up this trunk full of gold and run into town and stand in the middle of the street and start screaming, look what I've got, look what I've got? Is that your best strategy? What are you going to do? That requires some thought and consideration and decisions. And, you know, you have to be sharp in order to do that. But you can do it if it's important enough.
You know, the other thing I've always added to the equation from my personal experience is that the process can be transformational if you allow it to be. And it can be transformational in ways that you can't even anticipate, because one of the hangups I see people get is they think exactly what you're speaking to is that, what do I have to do now? What do I have to do with this information? And I've found that, yes, I agree, expression is a natural part, at least for me, of what I want to do with that. I want to express it. I want to share it. I want to find different ways to interact with it. But if I just let it fully integrate into who I am, into what my belief systems are, I'm transformed anyway, you know? So even if I'm not out there throwing Molotov cocktails at the G7 conference or protesting at Bilderberg or doing whatever I might do, I will be transformed if I follow the data wherever it leads.
Yes, sure. That's absolutely true. It is transformational. If you just let it be what it is, you see, if you just accept the fact, I'm not where I was 3 years ago.
Exactly. Right.
I'm not where I was 3 years ago. I'm in a much more expansive, powerful position than I was. Inside myself, I've changed. I'm not the same, I won't say I'm not the same person. You're you. You know, but this is bigger you. This is you breaking out of the egg you. This is breaking out of the shell you. And you've got to accept that, because it's a very, very good thing. And even accepting that by itself is a step forward, no question about it.
Well, John, this would be a great launching point into a whole other discussion we could have on a couple of emails we exchanged back and forth about consciousness and extended consciousness. You have some very deep thinking on that as well, and I think we'd have a great dialogue on that. We'll have to do that sometime, but we've already spent more than an hour here talking about really, really important kind of groundwork to lay in terms of how to arrive at new beliefs, how to challenge existing beliefs, and we've done it through the lens of your outstanding work on vaccines. Folks, you can check out John's blogs, No More Fake News, an incredibly rich site where there's constant information being added all the time. That's nomorefakenews.com. We'll have a link to that. Also to John's excellent blog, johnrappaport.wordpress.com. And we'll also have links to his excellent books. John, it's been fantastic having you on. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to John Rappaport for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview: did you know about the CDC whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson? If you did know, when did you know? How did you know? And what do you make of the fact that most of your friends, most of the people you know, don't know about this? Because that, to me, is the real story. How is something like this hidden in plain sight? So that's the question I think it would be fun to dialogue with you about. If you would like to join me in that dialogue, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can leave a comment right there on the website or jump over to the forum and join the dialogue over there. You can always reach me on Facebook as well or send me an email. I'm pretty available. I don't always get back right away, but sometimes I do, depending on what else is going on. But I love to hear from you, and I love connecting with people who are interested in these same topics and are interested in the Skeptico show. So please reach out and connect with me if you feel so inclined. I have some really interesting shows coming up, so many shows and investigations that I'm getting into that I'm anxious to bring to you. But rather than tell you everything that's going to be coming, I think I'll just wait and see how it unfolds and enjoy the process of sharing it with you and seeing what you think. So with that, do take care. And until next time, bye for now.